Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, producer's picks of the week. Highlights of the best What's Next episodes heard during a select week. On today's show, we'll hear three segments from episodes that aired last week, starting with...
The street we lived on, it was a politician that lived there. He was asking him, could he help his mother get out of jail or even help any kind of way. Told me the look on his face, he knew that he wasn't going to help. And matter of fact, they didn't want to even be a part of that.
A conversation with Geraldine Poynter, Terrence Poynter, and James Coughlin. We'll then move over to...
Now it has shifted, and we see employers are leery of hiring our clients or worried about it because they're worried that they would, understandably, invest in somebody, train them, and then they may have to leave.
A sit-down with Jennifer Rizzo-Choi, and we'll close with...
If we have an entire generation or at least a segment of the population that's considering not having children because of barriers at work, we need to look at work as maybe a reason why we don't see the types of population growth or the increases in birth rates that some policymakers are interested in seeing.
A discussion with Karen King, Kathy Creighton, and Rusty Weaver. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in. First, we revisit the story of Geraldine Poynter, who in 1967 was arrested after being accused of selling drugs out of a bookstore she operated on Jefferson Avenue. Jillian Hainsworth sits down with the members of the Justice for Geraldine and Martin campaign, which includes Geraldine herself, her son Terrence Poynter, and its lead organizer James Coughlin, as they discuss the charges, which the campaign believes were fabricated.
Today we are joined by a very spectacular woman, who's very important to our community. We're joined by Ms. Geraldine Poynter. Ms. Geraldine is a mother, a grandmother, like I said, a pillar in our community. She's truly a part of the foundation that educated and pushed the Black Power movement here in Buffalo in the 60s. Most notably, she was arrested in 1967, along with Martin Sostre, and accused of selling drugs and weapons out of a store that she owned at the time. We're also joined by her son, Terrence Poynter. Terrence was six when his mother was arrested. He is a survivor of trauma inflicted by a system that was not designed to protect his mother. And we're also, last but definitely not least, joined by James Coughlin, who is an employee at Burning Books and the lead organizer for the Justice for Geraldine and Martin campaign. And James is also a historian who focuses on the segregation in Buffalo and the impacts it has on our community. Welcome, all three of you. I'm really excited to have you.
Thank you.
Yeah, so Ms. Geraldine, I want to jump in. A lot of our listeners may have never heard of you or heard your story before. So first, introduce yourself. What do you want people to know about you?
Well, my name is Geraldine Poynter. When I got arrested in 1967, I was Geraldine Robinson. Geraldine Poynter is my maiden name, and I used that Geraldine Poynter because I didn't want my children harassed by some of the neighbors, knowing that their mother had got arrested and they didn't know why I got arrested.
So tell us about your life prior to the arrest. What were you doing in Buffalo?
Prior to my arrest, I was working at the bookstore for Martin Sostre. I worked at the one that was in the Fruit Belt. And I got to know a lot of the neighbors in the Fruit Belt, and they enjoyed coming to the store buying music. And they went to the store on Jefferson where they bought books about Black history or Black art or different things that Martin sold in the bookstore on Jefferson.
I've gotten a chance to talk to people who experienced that bookstore, and they always talk about the fact that they could come in, even if they couldn't buy the book, they could sit down in the bookstore and just get educated. How does it feel to know that you were a part of that? Like, that's big.
It makes me feel really good knowing that I was a part of that. And my children, they can even look back, the ones that were old enough to remember that things that happened in Buffalo back then.
Mm-hmm. So in addition to the bookstore, did you do anything else, or was that like your baby?
That was like our baby.
Yeah. Yeah. And can you tell us about Martin Sostre? Some of our listeners may have never even heard of Martin Sostre.
Well, you know what? He was a self-taught man, and he was a leader, and people looked up to him because of the things that he believed in. He believed in doing things for the community, waking up the black community of what was going on there.
Yeah, and what was going on?
Like back then when the riots and things were going on and different things that happened in the black neighborhood that people didn't know about. Martin was letting the people feel free to speak their mind about what was going on in the black community back then.
Yeah. So not only were you educating black people, you were also in a way mobilizing them to actually start to do things to make our community work for us.
Exactly. Exactly.
So if that's what you were doing, how did that work and that mission and that community-facing work lead to you being arrested and charged with selling drugs?
You know what? They didn't like the things that we were doing because he sold black literature, black history books, and they didn't want the black community to know the things that were going on because the black people were allowed to come into the bookstore, read the books, even if they didn't have money to pay for them. Mm-hmm. And that was all right with Martin. He was willing to share the knowledge without charging for it.
Yeah. And you know, when I think about that, I think about like the book bans happening right now. Like the effort to erase our history, to erase our education, to make sure that we are blind and uninformed has never stopped since.
Right.
Like,
it's they still don't want you to know what used to go on back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, a lot of people in Buffalo don't understand the history behind what has happened in Buffalo. So, James, I'm going to jump to you really fast just mm-hmm. for added context. Can you help our listeners understand how Buffalo was laid out, the communities, the segregation back in the 60s and the race riots and white flight? And
yeah, absolutely. So the 60s are kind of like the end of this like longer term process of black families migrating from down south to cities like Buffalo, but also encountering different forms of like discrimination and segregation, such as with like redlining policies where the federal government wouldn't provide any backed mortgages for folks in red line areas, which were in, you know, like the Ellicott area or the Maston, Cold Springs, so on and so forth. And in a lot of these neighborhoods too, they were initially like ethnically like German or Italian. And following World War II, as like you have more houses being built like around the suburbs, you have realtors and, like I said, the federal government incentivizing this process of white flight, and also realtors using ideas of race that white families have into this practice called blockbusting, where they would say, oh, your street is going to be turning over demographically, so you better sell your home while the market's hot, and we have this nice new home for you out in like Tonawanda or Amherst or Cheektowaga, whereas black families that are moving into Buffalo are given older housing that's turned into renting, housing that also gets destroyed by like urban renewal, such as with like the construction of the 33, or there's even an urban renewal plan in the Ellicott district right over here by downtown that happens even before the 33 gets constructed. So it's kind of the culmination in the 60s of that kind of decades long process.
Yeah, so that process is happening at the same time you are creating a safe space for black people, brown people to come and understand what's happening, understand how we got to where we were historically, and mobilize. Grassroots efforts were birthed out of your store. So when you say they didn't like that you were educating black youth and black people and keeping them informed, who is they?
I say the Buffalo police, the politicians, some of the ministers here in Buffalo, because I remember one politician specifically when I got arrested. And I just found this out not too long ago. My son was telling me the street we lived on, it was a politician that lived there. He was asking him, could he help his mother get out of jail or even help any kind of way? And he told me the look on his face, he knew that he wasn't going to help. And matter of fact, they didn't want to even be a part of that when I got arrested.
And while you were running the store and empowering youth, were there any signs that they didn't like what you were doing? Were there any threats, any like over-policing of that area? Like,
you know what? Not until after the riot, I'd never noticed anything like that.
Yeah.
Like I said, when all this happened, it happened like all of a sudden. And when they come busting in the store, I thought somebody was busting in there to rob us. I didn't know who they were, and I didn't even know what I was getting arrested for until I got out. I didn't even know the charges that they had put against me when I was arrested.
And I want to talk about that day, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. So first, Terrence, you spent time at this store. You were a part of this community, even as a small child. So can you explain from your perspective what kind of place the store was and what it was doing for our community?
Well, excuse me. The store was like, for a 6-year-old or 7-year-old, the store was like Wonderland.
Yeah.
You can go in the store and just listen to the newest records to come out. You know, you can, it's like your wildest dreams. You can go there and just, you know, escape. New
Safe
records
haven.
you can hear I mean, you can hear records on the radio, but when you come into the store, you have the brand new records. You can put it on there, you can play it and listen to it and play it again, you know. And just to be able to walk around the store and see different people every day, and every time you meet a new person, you learn something. So every day when they come in the store, I'm learning new stuff every day. I get to know people, I get to see their faces, you know what I'm saying? It's just like they took that away.
Yeah.
They took that away. You know, it just like, you know, it took everything from me at that time when I was really motivated to really become or do something. After that point right there, I was crushed as a 6-year-old, 7-year-old. My brothers too, because our mother was gone.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But the store at the time we were there was the best place in the world. Another good place was the library on Jefferson and Utica. We used to go in the library on Jefferson and Utica, go in the basement and watch movies. The library was like the
safe haven.
The best place, you know. You just have certain places you can go to. And like I said, it was enlightening you. It wasn't harming anybody. But I guess, you know, when you see people that fear you becoming educated, or when they fear your opinion, Why would they want to help you?
Right.
Why would I help you succeed in becoming you?
Right. So, realizing how great you are and everything you deserve.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
And you have siblings.
Yes.
4 siblings.
I have I had an older brother and a younger brother. They passed away now. And I have 2 sisters. I have a younger brother that was not born at the time.
Okay.
But
Were you there the day that your mother was arrested?
Not at the store, no.
Okay, you weren't at the store. Okay.
By the day my mother got arrested, we were my grandmother.
Okay.
And we didn't know anything about it. You know, it was just like a dream. You would
a nightmare.
Wake up and it's, you know, it's not a dream.
Yeah. At what point or what age did you realize what was actually happening?
Well,
like, I imagine it happened pretty quickly where you kind of had to grow up and understand.
What if the time when it really, really hit me hard was the first day when I had to sleep in a stranger's house. It was our foster parents. That's when it really hit me, like, this is going to be forever.
Wow.
this is going to be forever.
Were you in a foster home with your siblings?
Just me and my older brother.
Wow. And you thought that was just it?
That's what life was. This is going to be
forever.
Forever. It was just like coming from the sunshine and going into the darkness. You was just, it was over.
Yeah.
No motivation. I mean,
mm-hmm.
No motivation.
Right. I mean, I get it. The system took something from you that can't be replaced, which
exactly.
is time with your mom. Like, exactly. That's... Okay, so on the day you were arrested...
The night I was arrested.
The night you were arrested, what was going through your mind? Like, I know you said you thought someone was coming in, robbing you, but once you realized what was happening, like, how are you processing that?
Like I said, it was really hard to process because when they rushed in on us, like I said, I thought we were being robbed. And like I said, when we realized they were police officers was later. And like I said, all the police officers and detectives that was there wasn't one black one, not one.
Did they have on uniforms or were they in plain clothes?
No, they were in plain clothes. That's why I thought we were getting robbed.
Wow.
It wasn't a black person among them that came to when they arrested us. They were all white.
Yeah, so they came, arrested you, they took you to the holding center?
Yes.
And then how long were you, like, in the holding center?
You know what, I don't remember exactly, but I know I did get bailed out, and my mother or my family didn't come to bail me out, and that hurt. Strangers came and helped me.
Mm.
They put money or property up and got me out of jail.
Were they people who had experienced...
I guess so. They were, that was Martin's defense committee.
Okay.
And it was Jeanette Merrill. I remember her. Me and her became friends.
Mm-hmm.
And she was one of the ones that helped get me out of jail.
Mm-hmm.
Her and I remember Jerry Gross, Bob McCubbin, a lot of them I remember. And yes. They helped get me out of jail. They raised money and did different things to help to get me out of jail. And I appreciate it today.
Yeah. And Martin Sostre, he had a defense attorney, so he already had, like, a previous record or encounters with the police?
Yes, but after all this happened, he defended himself.
Yeah.
He acted as his own attorney.
Wow. Yeah, I heard so much about him. So did he have any suspicions that the space you were creating was at some point going to be a target?
Yeah, I don't know. He probably did.
Yeah, because
and like I said, during the daytime, when he was at the store, mm-hmm. different things probably happened. And he never said anything to me about it. That's why I didn't know.
Right. Okay, so you were arrested. You spent some time in the holding center. Some people who believe in the work that you're doing and the mission bailed you out. What was next? What did life turn into for you?
Well, it was really hectic because, like I said, it was hard for me and my children because, like I said, some of our family members didn't believe what had happened to us wasn't true or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that made it hard for me and my children because they didn't believe that I got arrested for no reason.
Yeah. And what were the charges?
Selling drugs. And I know I remember when... I went to court, the last time I went to court, when I got my sentence and they sent me to Albion, I remember 3.5 years or something like that. But before they said that, it was like 7.5 to 15. And like I said, when I heard that, I just blanked out. And all I thought about, when I get out, my children are going to be damn near grown.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't even hear them say 3.5 or whatever. And that was the sentence that I did, was the 3. I guess the 7.5 to 15... I didn't do that time. I did 3. I think it was 3.5 or whatever.
Yeah.
And I said, all I thought about when I heard him say 7.5 to 15, I didn't hear nothing about the 3. So I thought I was going to jail for 15 years for something that I didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And when you saw the charges, like, what went through your mind?
I said,
like,
no, I couldn't even believe it. Yeah. Me selling drugs. Or if whatever else the charges was, that wasn't me and I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable for somebody to accuse somebody of doing some horrendous things that they had on that paper.
That was Geraldine Pointer,
Terrence Poynter, and James Coughlin, three members of the Justice for Geraldine and Martin campaign. We'll then move over to a conversation on how recent immigration policy changes have impacted the region. We revisit a conversation Jay Moran had with Jennifer Rizzo Choi, the executive director of the International Institute of Buffalo. The two discuss how the Institute is navigating federal changes.
One of the great things that you have been able to do for this program in the few times that you've been on here is break down some of the really, conglomerate issues when it comes to immigration, the definitions, the nomenclature of refugees. Very important to separate that, as we have found throughout time, our time together here. At the same time, it seems recent news events and recent acts from the administration have kind of conglomerated a lot of this in all one big pile. Let's start with just what the International Institute has been doing for many, many years, and that's helping to resettle refugees to this area. What is the status right now of that situation?
So we have not had a new arrival since January 16th. On January 20th, Inauguration Day, the president issued a bunch of executive orders, a lot of which have impacted us and agencies across the country. And one of those was a suspension of the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program, USRAP, which we were expecting because that happened during the first Trump administration.
Right.
However, on January 24th, 4 days later, one of the executive orders that targeted foreign aid impacted us as well, because we received a stop work order from the Secretary of State. Resettlement money that comes in and allows us to do that initial support in the first 90 days actually comes from the State Department. So that fell under the foreign aid stop work order, which was covered extensively because you saw a lot of stuff happening with USAID overseas.
Right.
For us, it meant that the work that we were doing, immediately we had no money for. And we had people who had just arrived. And so, I mean, I remember very clearly that day. It was a Friday. I had just signed 20 February rent checks for families that had just come in. The Institute normally, through federal funding, pays rent, utilities, food costs, bus passes, et cetera, to get people started until we're able to get them into job club, get the kids enrolled in school, and get at least one, some of the family members enrolled in like welfare, Medicaid, et cetera. And so when we got that order, I just thought, we have to still pay rent.
Right, right.
They're not going to be able to pay it on their own. They arrive with nothing. So, that was an immediate effect, because the first time that we had the suspension happen in the first Trump administration, it just suspended future arrivals. It did nothing to address people who had just arrived, so that money still flowed. And so this time around, that suspension impacted 731 refugees who had just arrived in Western New York. Of those, the Institute had, I think, 203 were our clients. But, you know, there's four agencies in our community.
When you say you just had arrived, within what, the last month prior to that?
Since November 1,
okay.
They had
all
just
right.
arrived. So they were in that 90-day funded window,
yes.
where we all provide services and, you know, pay for their rent and utilities and all those things until we get them, you know, integrated into their lives in Western New York. So we're very fortunate that the Western New York community stepped in. We ran a collective fundraiser. The five organizations as a whole are part of the Refugee Partnership. So that's the Institute, Jericho Road Community Health Center, Journeys End, Catholic Charities, and Jewish Family Services. And the four resettlement agencies, the four except for Jericho Road, were all in this position where our State Department funds had been cut. And so we were able, through a campaign, to raise, I think it's at like $1.2 million. So it was really amazing. And we very much thank the Western New York community for that. That allowed us to we were all dipping into savings, essentially, to
sure.
pay for these costs. It's possible at some point the government will be ordered to be paying that money back to us.
There's litigation under this.
There's litigation on it, and there's judges who have ordered that they're supposed to pay us. But the reality is, we have not been paid for any of our federally funded work since January 20th.
Okay. All right. Very good. I just want to make sure, like you said, the emergency fund that was developed. It's interesting because, you know, there might be those who think that this region might have a split view when it comes to immigration and such related matters, but yet the community came through on its own, reached into its own pocket.
I think this is a place where people know where they came from, and whether, you know, it's they came recently from a place like Bosnia or Syria, or, you know, you trace back your ancestors and they came from, you know, Italy or Ireland or Poland. I think people realize that everybody here settles here, it becomes home, and they need some help in the beginning. I mean, that's why the Institute was founded back in 1918. It was to help newcomers get settled in. So I'm not surprised that we were supported so wholeheartedly from the community. I mean, a lot of local foundations made that first pledge in that really kind of got the, you know, the donation meter going up. But I think this is a very immigrant, hardworking town, and people realize the value of having people come and join our community. And it has contributed to economic growth as well as population growth here in our community.
I'm glad you mentioned the idea of the hardworking immigrant, because one of the things that we have found, and most certainly have found this through discussions with you and other people who are involved in helping with resettlement and immigration issues as well, just that fact that the people who have come to Western New York have found their way into employment and have continued to work from the get-go here. But now, with a lot of the changing status, I guess, for lack of a better term, that's been issued by the federal government, or most certainly confused, I think that's fair enough to say, confused regulations and guidelines, employers, what's their view of hiring somebody who just recently came to this country? What are we seeing now?
So initially, right after inauguration, we were getting calls from employers who've worked with us for years who were worried for their staff, were worried that they were going to have ICE showing up and conducting a raid. And these are employers who employ refugees, you know, which have a permanent status. Right. And so there was concern that, you know, they would have an unpleasant visit and something could happen to their employees, and they wanted to protect them. Now it has shifted, and we see employers are leery of hiring our clients. Or worried about it because they're worried that they would, you know, understandably invest in somebody, train them, and then they may have to leave. And so some of that comes down to confusion. And I'd like to talk a little bit about immigration statuses.
Sure.
So a refugee is somebody who's granted a permanent immigration status in this country. It is not like a temporary thing, like a visa, okay?
Right. This is not someone, just to lay out the scenario, somebody who recently showed up at the southern border in the last year or two seeking asylum. This is a totally different program.
Correct. So a refugee is someone who has to show that they have fled their homeland, that they have faced persecution, and they either fear it in the future or they have suffered past persecution on account of their race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or particular social group that they are in.
Right.
And so that's an adjudication that happens overseas by both the United Nations and then the U.S. The U.S. has a whole screening procedure, and people wait years to then legally immigrate to the United States. And so upon arrival, they're given a refugee status. Refugee status also comes immediately with employment authorization. So you're allowed to work, and that's permanent. And then from there, you proceed forward. You then move toward green card status, legal permanent residency, and eventually, hopefully, citizenship if they're able to speak English and pass the test. So that's a permanent status. With it comes work authorization. Just like if you have legal permanent residency and you have a green card, that has work authorization. But there are other statuses where people may be here temporarily, and while that status is active, they have work authorization. But when their status ends or it's revoked, the work authorization disappears. And I'm talking specifically about people who are on parole statuses.
Parole status.
So TPS has been talked about a lot. That's temporary protected status. Those individuals were granted a sort of a special program under the Biden administration. Specifically, it's called CHNV. Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans were able to go on to TPS, and that allowed them work authorization. They were not entitled to public benefits like, you know, food stamps or welfare, but they were allowed to work.
Okay.
That's a temporary status. It's usually like 1 or 2 years. It was a special executive grant. Ukrainians were allowed in under a temporary status called humanitarian parole, as were some Afghans who came in the beginning. the Afghans largely as a population have applied for asylum, have sought that legal process, and a lot of them have been granted asylum. When you're granted asylum, you are an asylee, and that's the same as a refugee where you have permanent work authorization and you can get a green card. But anybody who was on a temporary or humanitarian parole type of program, they're now in a limbo situation because the Trump administration has been revoking some of those parole programs. The CHNV program actually has been revoked, and people are supposed to be leaving before, I think it's April 24th, although that's now in litigation. But point being, a lot of employers hired people that were CHNV parole, TPS, and they're now realizing those employees may be leaving and they can no longer employ them.
And I want to, the parole status and the program that you just talked about that was suspended, and when we're talking about Venezuelans, people from Venezuela, people from Cuba, these are countries that, and correct me if I'm wrong or if you can give more context to it, then I'd appreciate it, but countries that American, U.S. policy has worked against those current administrations, and I think I thought I heard 8 million people left Venezuela. That, again, that might be a number I don't exactly have the grasp of. But the bottom line was, I mean, in some ways, it was a result of U.S. foreign policy.
I mean, there are definitely those critiques, you know, as people look at the historical conditions in different countries. And you know, if you look at it, the reality is that the United States has always struggled with migration at our southern border. Lots of countries do. Europe also struggles with migration coming up from Africa. You know, Germany struggles with migration from the Middle East, coming in from Turkey in particular. And so, you know, wealthier nations tend to have people that are trying to access their country via a land border, usually, sometimes a water border. And the United States has definitely had a lot of migration that's come up through countries like Venezuela and Colombia, et cetera. And depending on who's in office and the White House, then it becomes, how are they going to deal with that population? We see sort of a boomerang that's going on here, where the Biden administration tried to control the flow of migrants. At one point, it was about 2 million people a year. That was a huge number that was crossing, and they wanted to seek our asylum system, which is a very arduous, long process because they didn't do refugee processing overseas like resettlement refugees. They have to then go through that processing on U.S. soil, and it could take anywhere from like 2 to 5 years to get an answer. So the Biden administration then worked to create sort of these temporary programs to give them work permits. And now you see a different effect with a new administration coming in and saying, yeah, we're not going to grant that status. And so we're giving notice and you need to depart. And now everything's landing in the courts. So, you know, I think some scholars in this area have written and said things like, this is the impact of not really having a consistent diplomatic policy and process with these countries. And this is the spillover effect with the U.S. meddling in foreign countries' affairs.
Jennifer Rizzo-Choi is with us this morning on What's Next, Executive Director of the International Institute of Buffalo. We're getting into the refugee and immigration issues that are most certainly prominent for sure. Let's make sure, though, also, because every time I bring you in here, I want to hear these numbers again because they're mind-boggling. The number of refugees in the world and the projected number to come in the decades ahead.
So there's over 40 million refugees registered with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees worldwide. The UN also estimates that there's over 100 million internally displaced individuals, people who have like for instance, in a Sudan where they're displaced because there's conflict going on and they've moved within their country. So huge, huge numbers. The UN also is warning about climate refugees, where people's actual land and homeland disappears as it erodes in the coming, you know, next 10 to 20 to 30 years. Out of those millions of numbers I just talked about, the United States has a specific resettlement program that's been set up called USRAP. It's been in place since 1980. We actually just celebrated the 45th anniversary in March of that program, which has been a successful program. And the U.S. has taken in anywhere from like 60,000 to 125,000 people a year. It's a drop in the bucket,
right,
when you think about it, when you think about the numbers of people that could be coming. And it's a very small number compared to the roughly 2 million people that were estimated to try to cross the border last year who came in seeking asylum and wanting to become refugees but had to go through that legal process.
Is it fair to say that the current, I mean, you just mentioned the numbers, and like you said, it's a drop in the bucket when it comes to the total numbers of refugees in the world. But it's not unfair to say that the U.S. is abdicating any kind of leadership on this issue.
That is a common critique now, especially of our European partners in particular. You have to understand when the refugee process was set up. I mean, the world has always had refugees.
Right.
I mean, any time there's been conflict in the world, there have been people who have been displaced and people who have been targeted because of things they cannot change about themselves, the color of their skin, their religion, et cetera. But the world came to a reckoning in World War II with a huge persecution of a population because of their religion, you know, Jewish refugees. And so coming out of World War II, as I teach my students in class, you know, the international humanitarian protection regime was set up. Our diplomat and designee at that time was Eleanor Roosevelt, one of my personal heroes, who went there and they, you know, laid out the, you know, Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And we set up and we were a signatory to the 1951 Convention on refugees. And that's what set up the definition that I've talked about and the process. And each country then that signed, you know, agreed to do things, which include non-refoulement. We will not send somebody back to a homeland where they will be persecuted. That is a commitment that we made, as did other signatories. The United States decided to take it one step further. We created a funding program, the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program, embedded it in our law with the 1980 Refugee Act, which was passed by Congress and signed by the president. And so we have a designated process to handle people who come in through that waiting process, that vetted, secure process. That's like the 100,000 people a year. And then we set up a framework to allow people who reach our border to seek asylum and ask for the ability to stay. And that's that whole court process, which is the asylum seeking process. But, you know, every country has a different way of handling it. But a lot of these countries today are saying that the U.S., with some of the decisions that we're seeing now under this new administration, is backing off of its international law obligations, its treaty obligations, and its commitment to human rights and international refugee protection.
I put these questions on your plate when I have you here because I know you're not don't seem to have any trouble answering them. So I'll throw this one out there. What happened? What happened since 1980 that has changed this attitude? I mean, again, it wasn't as if the United States was, you know, bringing in a massive, overwhelming amount of refugees to this country. Like you said, you use the word drop in the bucket. And when you really think about the numbers in this world, it was and is, well, was a drop in the bucket. We can put it in the past tense, at least for the moment. What's happened? What's happened since that time, 1980? Or go back to 1951. Is it just short memories? People don't know their history? What do you think?
Oh, it's a lot of things. And I think it's education and the politicization of this topic. You know, the reality is that the refugee resettlement regime is separate from people who attempt to cross the border.
Right.
But and in fact, this was a program that was championed by Republicans in the 80s. You know, it was a successful program under the Reagan administration and the Bush administration. But immigration has become more of a fraught topic politically in the last 20 years as the United States, as many other countries, have struggled to control migration across their border. And somehow the topic of migrants and asylum seekers got conflated with resettlement refugees, and people aren't always willing to sit down and learn the difference. I mean, that's why I appreciate this format of this show, that we can talk about it and that people understand the difference. And I don't want to say one immigrant is better than the other, because there are no bad people. No one human is illegal. It's just a matter of how do you seek the process to find safety and protection. Not everybody is able to flee their homeland and get to a neighboring United Nations camp. The UN doesn't operate everywhere. That's a fact. But I think in recent years, as we've had larger numbers showing up at our border and it becoming a topic and a campaign point in presidential elections, people stop listening to the nuance of the difference and stop realizing that people are going to go where they need safety. I mean, no one is going to stay in a dangerous place if they are going to die and they can't feed their kids and they can't survive. And a big part of this is there's been a failure on behalf of our government in successive administrations, both Democrat and Republican, to really conclusively deal with, in a real way, the migration flow at the southern border. And so I do try, when possible, to talk about the refugee resettlement program and show that it's been successful and that it's completely different than their failures that have happened with migration. If you look at the refugee resettlement program, there was a study done that was a 15-year study that was performed by the U.S. HHS department. It showed that over 15 years of all the money that was invested into resettlement refugees and asylees, people granted status, through agencies like the International Institute and welfare and job training, et cetera, when you take what was invested in versus what they've contributed to our economy, there was $124 billion net benefit.
Wow.
By this population over a 15-year period. And we're talking about, I think it was like roughly 2 million people over the course of, you know, 15 years. So it does work. And if you look historically back, why did America grow and prosper when we had tons of migration in the early 1900s, the Italians, you know, my family, the 1910s, the 1920s? And there was a period of time where about 12 million people came in the first 30 years of the 1900 century, okay? And those were largely Italians, Puerto Ricans, and Irish. And that the America's economy and our industrial strength grew in that time, and it was credited to immigration. So, I mean, we've had benefits and gains. With that does need to be paired processing, national security concerns. I mean, we can't just have a complete open door where everybody walks in. But right. You need to have a rational conversation about your labor flow and your economic needs and how to structure people coming in to contribute to your country.
That was Jennifer Rizzo Choi, the executive director of the International Institute of Buffalo. We'll close out today's show with the conversation Jay Moran had with three individuals who spearheaded a report that breaks down the gender pay gap in Erie County. We welcomed Karen King, the executive director of the Erie County Commission on the Status of Women, and two members of Cornell University's Industrial and Labor Relations Buffalo CoLab, Kathy Creighton, the director of the CoLab, and Rusty Weaver, the director of research. The three discussed the report, titled Low Pay and Greater Barriers to Success, an examination of gender inequality in Erie County, New York.
Cornell University, they're the co-authors of the report, Lower Pay and Greater Barriers to Success. We were getting into what we, I guess, called the motherhood penalty or the caregiver penalty when it comes to the workplace. Let's get into maybe some numbers, and let's maybe get into what we've heard from our focus groups as well when it comes to this. What can you tell us?
Sure. So I know we covered the way that we arrived at a lot of these numbers before, but again, we tried to find the pay gap between folks who are doing similar work, who have the same occupational background, the same credentials, and all of that. But then we also looked in at key focal variables of how we could estimate average wages between men and women in those roles to see if there were key variables or factors that really stood out as potentially drivers or at least non-random associations here. Sure. With the pay gap. And so the overall gap, like we mentioned, in overall earnings for all workers is about $274 per hour. So women on average are earning about $274 per hour less than men in similar roles and situations. But when we looked at specifically families or persons who are raising their own children as part of a couple, it could be a married couple or a same-sex household couple. When we look at the parents in those situations, men on average are, and again, controlling for all of those other relevant factors, are earning about $28.13 per hour compared to women who are at less than $25 per hour. So the gap there is almost $3.20 per hour. These cases don't happen often, but that's, imagine that a man and a woman, a husband and wife, are raising their own kids in the exact same job. They went through the same schooling and everything. They're the same people. The dad is earning about $3.20 per hour more than the mom, even though they're doing the same work. And then that coupled with when we did focus groups of folks, we already talked about how women recognize that they're also disproportionately doing the care work at home too. So they're being penalized, I want to say once at work, twice at home maybe, because they're doing a disproportionate share of the work. So it's this dual burden, if anything else. But recognizing that women who didn't yet have children in the focus groups that we participated in, maybe weren't even thinking about having children, talked about a lot of the barriers in their work to them even considering having children. And so service sector workers in particular talked about their schedule variability, the fact that they're effectively always on call because they might need to go cover a shift for someone else, and the unpredictability of their schedules because they only get them sometimes a week in advance, and so they can't rearrange to do anything, and they're working odd shifts or odd hours too. We did a focus group of just service sector workers, and none of them said that they were thinking about having children in the near future because of the constraints that they see at work. They didn't understand how they would balance motherhood or being a parent with the type of work that they're engaging in. And so in a country where, you know, where our death rate is higher than our birth rates, where we're seeing new restrictions on immigration, those are the ways that populations grow. And so if we have an entire generation or at least a segment of the population that's considering not having children because of barriers at work, we need to look at work as maybe a reason why we don't see the types of population growth or the increases in birth rates that you know, some policymakers are interested in seeing.
Wow, that says a lot. How did that go in the focus group?
There were a lot of younger women who were, well, all right, let me step back for a second. So in the focus group, we asked women about their work-life balance, and virtually every woman said that they bear most of the burden of the family life, that they reported that they work harder than their husbands because they have to do their paid work, and then they have to come home and be the primary parent and manage the household and manage the kids, and also then manage elderly parents. And it was noted that children grow up or children get sick, and you have a child and somebody has to stay home with the child when the child is sick, and that, say, for public school teachers, that's more often the mom who would stay home rather than the dad who would stay home. And so those are ways that at work you're sort of getting penalized for being a lower performer because you're having to take sick days or personal days because your child is sick. And then it also was very notable how many women felt really overwhelmed by their life, that they had to go to work and then they had to come home and work like basically another shift. And I'll just read you, if I could, some quotes from some.
Please.
One woman said, "I get very little sleep. I'm holding on like a thread. And I work with vulnerable people, so I have to perform really well at work. And then it's very draining. And when I come home, I don't have what I need at home." Another woman said, "Juggling is hard, and it never gets to an equilibrium, depending on a sick kid or a sick parent." Another person used this sort of analogy. She said, "I show up at work with a full matchbook." She's obviously a little bit older because she's talking about matches you might remember. A full matchbook. She said, "But every step takes a match, and by the time you get to your own time, you have zero matches left because someone has ripped those out of you, and no one is filling our cup back up. I do my job, but also do children, grocery, cooking. We don't get recognized for what it takes, for what that takes away." From us, from taking away our these matches. I like that. Sort
and
of
I like the ripped out.
Ripped out.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's some powerful words there.
And then, you know, we heard from a number of younger participants who were in the focus groups with these older women, and they said, "Well, this is why I would never have a child, because I have to have a job. I have to have a job because I have to pay my bills and I have to earn an income. And I don't want to have that burden of managing my job and my family." And as Rusty said, that's a very societal, long-term, concerning problem that that we need to be thinking about.
And I think it's important to create some context around this. I mean, the workplace is historically somewhat of a hostile place. And any changes that have been made, any progressive changes to make it a more inclusive, healthier, safer, fair place has been at the demand of workers, which, you know, we'll talk about the importance of labor unions and collective bargaining in a minute. But so this has always been a struggle. And when women are when women enter in the workplace, you know, historically they entered in specific roles. They worked in low-paying factory, dangerous work, life-threatening work. And as time progressed, they started entering into more middle management or higher status work. But this tension of, you know, what their role really is has always been in play. So this idea of being the primary caretaker hasn't changed. We've made more accommodations. We've created family pay leave. We've encouraged, you know, fathers to take time off. You know, we've done several interventions. But at the root, you know, those ideas are really entrenched in our society. So that's why creating these interventions, you know, like unions and pay transparency, are so important, because what we really need to do is transform the workplace into a more hospitable space for working families, you know, men, women, people who want to have children and procreate and keep the population thriving. We have to make those workspaces more inclusive.
In the report, there is a really stark and very interesting element about unionization. And it almost seems, I guess, counter when you think of traditional, again, you know, stereotypes of the union work. I'm thinking of my father and my grandfather, union guys here in Erie County. But women seem, according to this report, benefit when it comes to wages, when it comes to being in unions.
Yeah, I'd say, just to follow up on that, everybody benefits when unions are involved. So what we found with Erie County is that being a member of a labor union, or even just being covered by a union CBA, increases wages for everyone. However, there's been a recent trend in the data that we looked at, really since the pandemic era forward, that while wages were being increased for everybody, they were still being increased a little more so for men than women. But everybody, again, was benefiting. Union women were out earning non-union women. Union men were out earning non-union men. But since the pandemic, that's changed. The data that we have for Buffalo Niagara show that women, the union premium for women workers has actually been a little bit higher than the union premium for men in recent years. That was especially apparent right around 2020. And while we don't have causal data on this, the speculation that we have is, when you look at those prominent industries that we have in Buffalo, Niagara, and health and social services, those are essential services. Those are frontline jobs that were always active, even during the depths of the economic shutdowns. And those are predominantly women, as we've already argued here for Erie County and Buffalo, Niagara. And so women were working more, probably getting paid overtime, especially if they were in a union, because there's a wage book. You know how much you're supposed to be making. Right. You know what the overtime rate is. And so there's that transparency. And why unions are such a valuable piece of maybe solving these gap problems is for that reason. There's transparency in what folks are earning. You know that you have an organization that's going to fight for you to make sure you're getting your overtime pay and that wage theft isn't an issue. And so when you have those supportive infrastructures at work, the results are good for everyone, but they've been particularly good for women, as we've said, in the past few years here in Buffalo, Niagara.
And again, that's something that might run counter to labor critics, organized labor critics, right? That in a workplace that, you know, management doesn't want the union influence in a workplace because it's going to restrict the ability to keep everybody happy, to make sure that everybody's in the roles they want.
Yeah, that's just bunk.
Yeah.
I mean,
thank you.
Yeah,
thank you for using that four-letter word.
Yes. Because, you know, in every part of America, in every workplace that has a union, the wages go up substantially. And that doesn't account for massive increases in benefits. So if you're a member of a labor union and you have a collective bargaining agreement, you see increases in your health care, you see increases in pension contribution, you see better vacation, paid time off. And then unions advocate at the state level and the federal level for changes that we're talking about here, like paid family leave. They understand those are important to working people, and so they advocate in a collective voice, because one person, even we see in these focus groups, one person standing alone can't make a change. But the germ of change comes from, there it goes again, the germ of change, it comes from collectivism, right? From solidarity.
Yeah.
So, yeah, of course employers are going to say they don't want a union because they have to share profits or find money for workers as opposed to themselves. you know, that's really where we're at. And that's part of what we suggest in our paper, is that unionization efforts should be promoted. And, you know, currently at the federal level, they're being decimated. So that's not a good trend.
Yeah, I'm tempted to get into some of the federal trends that we're seeing here, but I don't want to take away from the work inside this report as well.
Can I say one thing,
please,
about the fact the federal versus local? So local change has never really been more important. And as data is disappearing, the data that Rusty and Cornell looks at when we do research like this, social science research, as that data is potentially disappearing.
Just explain why you say potentially disappearing. I'd like you to expand on that.
Rusty, you want to take that question about what's happening?
A number
of
the data collection initiatives at the federal level are either in flux. A lot of websites that have hosted data are currently down. Now, there have been researchers out there archiving those past data sets, but there is a lot of uncertainty about whether data that we're going to get in the future is going to look like the data that we've had in the past and allow us to monitor and track the same types of indicators.
Yeah, and just to expand on that just a little bit, we were talking earlier about the equal pay days, and we mentioned how LGBTQIA+ Equal Pay Awareness Day is June 17th, and that's because the data when it comes to sexual orientation is maybe not totally available. And we also hear, certainly on the federal level, that a lot of that is going to be perhaps cast away.
Exactly. And that has huge negative implications for equal rights and human rights across the landscape of our society. You know, to your point, the U.S. Census Bureau, through the American Community Survey, had recently started asking a question that helped us identify whether somebody is in a same-sex couple. It doesn't get to their sexual or gender identity specifically,
sure,
but that's at least one step in the direction where we would be able to potentially look for unequal outcomes or unequal opportunities between different types of individuals. I can't say for sure that we're still going to be asking that question going forward, or if that same sort of data is going to be available from here on out.
And also in the report, I did see about support for an equal rights amendment on a federal level. This is more of an anecdotal thing, I think, but it was quite stark.
Oh, yeah. The support for the equal rights amendment is very high among men and women.
Yes.
I think that goes towards the trend of advancing women's rights, but we're stuck, aren't we? We feel like we're stuck.
It's rigidity. A constitutional amendment takes significant work at the state level, and state legislatures, as we've seen, have been, you know, pushed in a certain ideological direction that's maybe opposite of some of the points that we're talking on here recently. And so to think about how the system that we've built would lead to an equal rights amendment at the federal level in the current political landscape, like Kathy said, it's a stuck position.
All the more reason why gender parity in elected office is important, because research has shown that when women are proportionately represented in legislative positions, that women-friendly policies are created and enforced and supported. But that's one of those key factors that are necessary to get us unstuck.
And that will do it for Producers Picks of the Week. We thank our guests, Geraldine Poynter, Terrence Poynter, James Coughlin, Jennifer Rizzo Choi, Karen King, Kathy Creighton, and Rusty Weaver. If you missed anything or just want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts, including the full individual episodes aired in today's compilation. Each episode is online at btpm.org. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for listening.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.